Now stay tuned for the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call talks with the people in Charlottesville and Albemarle County who are making a difference. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us on another Sunday morning. We're going to talk today about the future of schools, much more so than just what September and October are going to look like in Albemarle County, as we did last Sunday. Today, we're going to talk with Pam Moran. She's the executive director of the Virginia School Consortium for Learning. You may know Pam as the Charlottesville-Albemarle area superintendent for the Albemarle County school system from 2006 until her retirement in 2018. During her tenure, the county opened specialized academies at its three comprehensive high schools, the Math, Engineering, and Science Academy at Albemarle High School, the Health and Medical Sciences Academy at Monticello High School, and the Environmental Studies Academy at Western Albemarle High School. She was also named Virginia Superintendent of the Year in 2015. Also with us today, we have Ted Dintersmith. He's an author, films, and videos creator, and his new book is called What Schools Could Be. Mr. Dintersmith believes our education priorities will make or break our nation's long-term prospects. He was a legislative analyst in the U.S. Congress, focused on technology policy. In 2012, he was appointed by President Obama to represent the U.S. at the United Nations General Assembly. In 2018, he received the prestigious NEA Friend of Education Award. And the latest book, What School Could Be, and with films like Most Likely to Succeed, are what brought his attention to the U.S. Welcome, Ted and Pam.
Great to be here.
Glad to be here with you, Rick.
So we have an hour to talk about the future of schools. So I don't know that we can get it all in. So maybe I'll need to bring you back next week and the week after. but there is an awful lot going on because when we look at where schools were in February, when people talked about the future of schools, and then you have to change the schools because of the COVID virus and how things have gone because of how we'll do schools because of technology and how many kids are going to stay home and how we're going to teach and will this be more permanent and et cetera. So the future of schools, people discuss as to whether this will be more permanent than just a half semester or one school calendar year. And so I'm curious, and Ted, I'll start with you. You've been talking about schools needing to change in many ways. Is the 2020 to 2021 concept of more kids at home working online with teachers in one place, teaching to kids virtually, is this what you were talking about in February?
Well, not to be equivocal, it depends. And I think what we've seen over the last few months is a wide variety of approaches. And the best way I can communicate or express it is with an analogy I think most people are quite familiar with, which is teaching someone how to fish versus feeding someone fish. And what I really focus on in my books and my films are schools, you know, classroom teachers, places that really focus on teaching kids how to fish. And by that, I mean in the education setting, working with kids so they identify what they want to learn. They get good at the skills to manage and direct their own learning and access to resources, whether it's the time of an adult, the teacher, or a parent, or a classmate, or an online resource. But they get good at accessing the appropriate resources, and then they come up with really interesting initiatives they want to create and actually carry it forward, stick with it, and make it happen. And in February, I thought that was a great idea, and write about a lot of places that do that. And Pam could talk to you about it because she's one of the people I've learned the most from in my journey. But I think that was all the more important in March and in April. And I think it's going to be just as important in October, November. Who knows how long this disrupted period will last. But the point that I think is worth making is that's exactly what's important when you become an adult. You know, it's not like we're saying, let's take a detour because of COVID and have kids learn how to fish instead of eating fish. The reality is, adult organizations want to hire somebody who's good at identifying opportunities to make the organization better, draw on resources, learn what they need to learn to get it done, and just stick with it until they've made real contributions. And so to me, it's sort of like highlighting what we should be doing instead of disrupting what we were doing before. Because the fact is, if you were in a school environment that was just feeding kids fish, I don't think it really worked that well in school. But then what I say is that good luck making kids eat virtual fish. And so it didn't work well in the first place, and it was a disaster this spring. So that's why I said there were big disparities.
So, Pam, what I'm hearing is that it doesn't matter whether the kids are in school or at home. Changing the location that they're learning is what we're focused on. When are we going to change the curriculum?
Rick, you always go right to the core. But I know you have education folks in your family, so you know the questions to ask. It's a great question. That the reality is, and this is coming from what I would describe as not just a data focus, but also a personal belief system, that one of the things that's worried me for a long time is that we know that learning occurs when people are engaged, when their brains are engaged, when their thinking is engaged, when even their hands and their bodies are engaged physically in the process of learning how to do things, not just acquire knowledge. And something that we know from a series of surveys done over the last decade and more by the Gallup folks is that they have now come close to surveying several million students over time. And what they find is that the level of engagement that kids report in the learning they're doing in school is fairly, I guess, moderate in fifth grade, drops significantly by the time kids are in middle school, and by the time kids are in high school, ending their high school career, it's pretty abysmal that maybe only 30 or 35% of the kids actually report themselves as being engaged in school on a daily basis, that they tend to disconnect from the learning that we're trying to get them to become a part of as they go through a school day. And one of the things I've said to folks who've talked about, well, you know, we have so many kids that are disengaged in this virtual learning that we're trying to do. I said, disengagement is not a problem that just emerged with virtual learning. Disengagement is a long-term problem in our schools, and it's one of the reasons why we have a few kids that, you know, if you wanted to find success by grades or SAT scores, and Ted, I'm sure will jump in on that one, do pretty well. And we have a lot of kids that do, well, by the same measures, kind of okay. And then we have kids that literally, you know, we are just losing from the system. As I had a kid one time say to me at Almonk High School, said, you know, Dr. Moran, I shouldn't have to check my creativity at the door when I come into school every day. And, you know, I had to say I agreed with her. So for me, it's not about location, although I do think I am a real proponent of kids being together because they have told me over the years that their time with peers is incredibly important. Their time with really extraordinary teachers, with teachers that care about them, that have relationships with them, adults that are that way with them, whether it's in school or out, that kids value learning from adults who care about them and they have relationships with, and they value time with their peers. Some of that can happen pretty okay in terms of virtual learning. We've seen some good examples of it as we've gone through these last couple of months. But I'm going to get off that soapbox. I think that the most important thing that we've got to do, and it kicks back to what Ted was saying about teaching kids to fish, not doing the fishing for them. We've been doing far too much fishing for kids in the way that we build curriculum and develop instruction for kids. It's not created a culture of student talk and action. It's been for most of the 20th century in many classrooms, if not almost all, a culture of teacher talk. And that's not engaging for kids.
I'll just add one thing. One thing that I find so interesting is if I observe really young kids, let's just say kindergarten kids, they're just bubbling with curiosity. They ask the best questions, and they're willing to take all sorts of chances because they don't worry about failure. They really don't care that much about how they look to their classmates. And people say, oh, my gosh, they're learning at a mile a minute, and what they're learning, they retain. You know, we have it all right. You know, like with kids that age, there's so many things that are going right. And actually, all those characteristics I just described are exactly what you'd want in a young adult. And then fast forward to high school, and Pam has seen a ton of high school classes, and I've seen a lot. You know, I travel all the time. Well, now I don't. But anyway, when you can travel, I travel all the time. And, you know, high school, most of the time, the only question the kids ask is, will this be on the test? And they're just kind of going through the motions. And I think that element of engagement that Pam talked about so powerfully is just what we take away from kids. And it's possible to go high school, even through college, much of college, maybe even all of college, without anybody ever saying, what do you want to learn? You know, what direction do you want to take this? And what's something creative and original you'd like to produce tied to your intellectual interest? And that, to me, is the key to whether kids are learning deeply and joyfully and actually retaining it versus whether they're sort of going through the motions.
Yeah, and we know that from a lot of research on the brain and learning that the majority of what we expect kids to memorize is gone within 24 hours to no more than a few months. And Ted is in Most Likely to Succeed. His movie really profiled that, I think, with advanced placement research, Ted, in terms of that kids can pass the test and then turn around a few months later, and it's pretty much, for the most part, not retained.
It's gone.
And,
isn't it, and you worry, right, that are we actually rewarding the ability to jam stuff into short-term memory? And if that's what we're rewarding, you know, then we're not doing our kids, you know, a good service long-term. But, yeah, we had that example. There was a different example about a school in Princeton, New Jersey, Lawrenceville Academy. I love this example because it's such an expensive high school. It's a boarding school that parents will pay $70,000, $75,000 a year to send their kids to Lawrenceville. And they had their kids, when they came back in the fall, retake. Initially, they thought the finals from the spring. And then the teacher said, oh, there's low-level stuff on the finals that we're not sure they remember. So they said, well, take out all the low-level stuff. Just retest them on all the essential concepts you're sure every kid mastered. And the average grade went from a B-plus to an F. And in 2 years across lots of subjects, not one kid remembered everything that they thought all kids had mastered. And you know, so if it's not applied, if it's not absorbed, if it's not learned in a context where the kid's really motivated to learn and understand it and actually engage in some sort of hands-on application of the knowledge, it's transient. And at that point, you just sort of say, what was the point?
Yeah. And, you know, there's no place in the curriculum that probably Ted gets any more passionate about, and it's been a passion of mine because I see it as such a gateway to being able to think analytically, to be able to really understand the world through a data set, and that's in math. And when you talk about that, the way that we have in this country, and it's not true everywhere, but it is in the United States, structured curriculum and instruction in math, and we've seen attempts over the years to try to make changes, but we've not been very successful. We, you know, are, and I think we've really seen it to some extent through the last few months in terms of people's capabilities to wrap themselves around some of the data set that comes out of the COVID day-to-day information that people are expected to be able to process. But, you know, Ted and I have talked extensively, and I've watched him ask questions of audiences that are seemingly fairly simplistic mathematical concepts in terms of what math teachers would tell you, and have entire audiences of high school seniors, mostly who have taken through AP Calculus, not be able to answer math questions that are basic to really having some deep understanding of just mathematical thinking. And so that really, you know, I think is a great concern for us in a digital age where, you know, technology abounds in our world. And our expectation is, and information is coming at kids faster than the speed of light almost, in terms of what they're expected to be able to process. And if you don't have a really good, sound understanding of mathematical concepts and a capability to see the world mathematically, you can get kind of lost. And there are all kinds of opportunities in life, as well as necessities of understanding information, that are inaccessible to a lot of adults in this country. And I think that we still have a lot of work to do, Ted, in that area.
And big opportunities. If we have the courage to rethink math, kids at age 18 leaving high school would have amazing career opportunities. But we don't. I mean, no one would tolerate, if we sent our kids to driver training school and expected driver training school to teach them how to drive a car, and they came home every night, they were memorizing the parts of a carburetor and never drove a car, I think we'd all say, this is wrong. You know, what are you doing? This makes no sense. And our innovative driver training schools and Department of Motor Vehicles don't look at parts of a carburetor. They actually see if you can drive a car. But that, in math, we teach kids to memorize the parts of carburetors. I mean, they do all these low-level procedures that their phone does instantly correctly. And they're tested on that because they're really great micro problems for the test designers. But when people say, and I've got a really good math, I know something about math, is they say, well, it's a fundamental on the way to understanding how to use it. That's not true. It teaches you how to think. No, that's not true. When Rand did a study, they said 98% was low-level pattern recognition. It's really just doing these micro procedures quickly under time pressure, because that fits with an SOL or fits with an SAT. And I talked last month to Steve Levitt, who was the author of Freakonomics, and they do a really great podcast. They surveyed the Freakonomics podcast listeners, which are a very techie, nerdy group. It said, how many of you regularly use algebra, geometry, trig, and calculus? The high water mark was 4%. I mean, 4% of Freakonomics listeners use geometry, and for the other three, they used it even less. And you say, oh, my gosh. And what gets pushed to the side generally is statistics, which is an incredible career door opener, important for being an informed citizen, and really kicks in and plays an important role in many of your most important personal decisions, certainly investment, finance decisions, and health decisions. And most of the time we say, oh, no, don't take statistics, take calculus. And yet I spent 6 years, and I just, this isn't braggy, but people should know, I have a PhD in math modeling from Stanford. So that's why I say I know a little bit about this stuff. I spent 6 years trying to find one adult in America who uses what's taught in high school calculus professionally. So far, zero. You know, I've been to Boeing. I've been to 3D solid modeling companies. I've been to a lot of places playing Where's Waldo. Who uses high school math calculus professionally? No one. And so why would we tell kids take calculus instead of statistics? And the answer is obvious. That's what college admissions officers want. That's what would be a prerequisite at UVA for a business degree, which is laughably stupid. But anyway, that's how it works. Is it's just terribly obsolete, and it's doing a disservice to our kids.
Well, and I think it really it cuts across a lot of curricular areas. We could take that one and run it through history and English language arts and science, and really talk through how we have missed the boat with curriculum. But I will also tell you there are outliers out there. And in Virginia, one of the things that's happening right now is a refocus on how do we really make history something that is really representative of the narrative of where we have been and where we are today, but also how do we move it forward.
And so we have our guest today, Ted Dentersmith, author, creator of films and videos, and Pam Moran, Executive Director of the Virginia School Consortium for Learning. We'll be right back. All right, here we are back in action, Sunday morning wake-up call, talking about the future of schools with our guest, Pam Moran, Executive Director of Virginia School Consortium for Learning, well-known around here as the Albemarle County Superintendent, 2006 to 2018, and Ted Dentersmith. He's an author. His new book is What School Could Be, creator of films and videos. You can go to his website, Ted Dentersmith. Just look it up. It'll take you to some amazing places. Pam, one of the things that I mentioned in the intro is that Albemarle County Schools introduced some academies in the school system, the Math, Engineering, and Science Academy, the Health and Medical Sciences Academy, and the Environmental Studies Academy. That is, I don't know that it's part of, or tell me more about it in a short time frame, because it sounds like it's what we're talking about, a change in the curriculum, a produce something for me kind of mindset.
Yeah, I would say that you know, we did a lot of test bedding work as we were really trying to reframe the way we thought about teaching and learning from looking like 20th century traditional desk and rows compliance driven learning to learning that really actively engaged kids, got them working on challenging problems and getting them to really own solutions through whether it was project-based learning or maker work or any of the kinds of things that we were after. But the academies gave us an opportunity to really start to think about what happens if we think about how we use time and scheduling differently. What if we start to think about how we connect curriculum across curriculum versus just having it in isolated silos? What if we go to more of a hands-on, minds-on, project-based approach where kids are learning things that we adults think are important, but they're learning it in the context of work that matters to them? And I'll never forget, you know, some of the incredible science projects that kids did that really, you know, cut across citizen science, STEM, health and medical opportunities that kids were having as interns out in the community. And one of the things that I think we learned from that is it wasn't just something that would benefit some kids, but it was something that would really benefit all of our kids to make those kinds of changes. And I think that one of the things that I learned as Ted and I started interacting is that we were not alone, that there were places all over the country, what I might call outliers, that were working on similar concepts of how do we change up the narrative of what school has been in the 20th century to what schools could be in the coming decades in this one. And I will tell you, Rick, that one of the things that I think about sometimes is that the child that's entering kindergarten this year as a five-year-old is going to be likely living, many of them, into the 22nd century, given life expectancies, and that we're not just educating kids today for the 21st century, we're now educating for the 22nd century. So, Ted, I'm going to kick that over to you.
That's a scary thought, actually. So there are a lot of things. I'll highlight the fact that I actually talk a lot about Pam and the great work she did in the district there in my book. And she is one of the real innovators in the country. And it's not easy to change an existing school district, particularly one that by conventional measures looks successful. But she affected a lot of great transformations. And I think one of the ones I put at the top of the list is finding initiatives that students are drawn to, that they're interested in, that have a connection to the real world. And it could be a music composition lab. It could be the three academies she started. But it always started with engagement. Find that hook that gets a kid wanting to be at school. And when it's connected to some real world impact, that kid is very motivated. One of the things I think, you know, and I'll put this dare out there because I do this a lot, is that when you actually do more hands-on or pragmatic learning, I think it's actually a powerful way to understand the theory. And I think oftentimes when you are immersed in the theory, you lose sight of what actually happens in the real world. And so I have a few sort of interesting science questions, and I'll ask them to people from all walks of life. And I often find on something that really reflects how the real world functions and operates, that the university professors will get it wrong and the master electrician will get it right. And so the ability for kids in middle and high school to get a sense of what a real, you know, an electrician does, how they make wiring safe and sound, how they test loading. There are a lot of really fascinating aspects to making, you know, an electrical system work in a house that gives the kid a much better appreciation of the fundamental science, the fundamental physics of electricity. And I think it's been very unfortunate, and Pam has reversed that, and Albemarle has, but in most parts of the country, they haven't at all. You know, shop class disappeared a long time ago. And the result is we get a lot of kids that are dealing with this sort of thin veneer of academic formalism, and it works well for the test designers because it's really easy to design an AP physics test that gives you Kirchhoff's law and has you plug in parameters and get the answer right or wrong. And it's, you can't really do a standardized test of troubleshooting a home electrical system, but that applied expertise is actually where the real insights come. And so I think there's a huge opportunity, and I'm going to double down on what Pam said, of not thinking of career academies and a real world focus as something for some kids, you know, not as a consolation prize for the kids that can't do the academic symbolism, but for all kids, because I think it's actually a better window. And I think I've been tempted to sort of grant, you know, for every Nobel Prize that's won in an experimental science, I guarantee you the real work was done by the lab technician who often didn't go to college, but just makes things work. I think we need to celebrate, elevate, understand that that's really a preciously important capability. And we need to have more of that for kids in schools because it gives them better insight into what they're studying. It gives them a sense of purpose from seeing how it plays out in the real world. And it lets different kids with different strengths shine in school instead of identifying a handful as being gifted because they can play around with Kirchhoff's law quickly under time pressure. Whereas the kid that's really good with their hands that can make an electrical system work, that kid's incredibly gifted and should be honored and celebrated for that as well.
So two questions here. First, let me let everybody know that our guest today, Dr. Pam Moran, known around our area, Albemarle County Superintendent from 2006 to 2018, currently at the Virginia School Consortium for Learning, Ted Dentersmith. He's an author and creator of films and videos. You can find his new book, What School Could Be, as we talk about the future of schools. So two questions. First one, Pam, I asked you about the academies, and I heard a deep sigh. Did I not?
Well, I think that one of the things that I've learned, not only when I was still on the job as superintendent, but even so since then, in working with school divisions around the state of Virginia, and one of the things that we've done as a startup is the Virginia's for Learners Innovation Network, which is supported by my organization, the Department of Education in Richmond, Jobs for the Future, which has some Hewlett funding, and TED, who has a real vested interest through his foundation and supporting up innovation in schools is that as I've run into more and more educators, and it was this is what really got me when we first started up the network, the Virginia's for Learners Innovation Network. We thought that if we had 15 school divisions that were interested in that concept in the first year of networking around local innovations to implement what's called the Virginia Profile of a Virginia Graduate, which looks at communication, critical thinking, creativity, collaboration, and citizenship as key areas of focus that we would want all of our graduates to develop competencies around. We had almost 60 school divisions that wanted to have a team in the original cohort one of that network. And so it struck me that there is a lot of interest, excitement, and real desire on the part of educators to look at how do we innovate up so that our kids are really prepared for life in the coming decades, to be able to thrive, whether it's at home, at work, in the community, across citizenship, across service, across work, across being a good family member. They were really interested in how to do that. And key to that was that it shouldn't be something that we should just reserve to some kids, that it should be the kind of work, the kind of innovative focus that we would want for every student. And some would label that as an equity focus. I know that at our Department of Ed, they see that as, and it, this means every child, regardless of where they live in Virginia, should have access to opportunities that allow them to really be successful around that Profile of a Virginia Graduate kind of work, and not just passing the old SOL test. In fact, the state's gotten rid of a number of tests and is considered sort of a model for the rest of the nation in terms of taking a turn towards a different way of thinking about what education really means at this point in time versus in the past. And we're really fortunate. Ted's a native son of Virginia and has been very interested in trying to help support up the efforts that we're making that really are local efforts. There's no cookie-cutter solution to this, and I think Ted found that when he visited every state in the nation, that, you know, that innovation can be as different in, you know, Southwest Virginia from Northern Virginia as it is from California to Maine. And so, you know, that's one of the things that I think is that for too long, we've really held teachers who have a real commitment to working with children and doing the right thing for kids and themselves wanting to be engaged. One of the things that's pretty scary about that Gallup data is that this is an interesting point. Teachers in some cases report higher levels of disengagement from their work than the kids do. And that's because we, to a great extent, have taken the joy out of the teaching and learning process. And that's something that when Ted uses that word joy, that's a really important word for us to think about. I don't know how you attach a metric to it, but we all know when it's there and we all know when it's not. And so I think that the academies were a start. I think Albemarle is really continuing to focus on how do we really bring those kinds of experiences in a more equitable way to all kids. But I think that that's something that really we've got to be able to ignite that across the country if we're going to see ourselves continuing to thrive, not just as a culture, as a nation, but as individuals and communities. And I get pretty passionate about that real urge for us to really act upon the need to support the educators in our schools as the frontline innovators and not always see somebody from outside is being able to bring that in.
So, Ted, I want to throw this to you. We got about 3 minutes, so we can have a part A and a part B to this. But Pam mentioned testing. So I think last year, at the end of the school year, there were a lot of SAT tests were canceled. There's the expectation that similar applications for colleges, same thing might happen. Is testing losing its need for college entry Or is this going to happen for just 1 or 2 years of high school grads?
I think there's some pretty encouraging trends. I mean, the University of California system, which is vast, and schools like UCLA and Berkeley get 100,000 applications. They announced not just that they're suspending, they're eliminating the SAT or ACT as part of their admissions criteria. And every time anybody looks at those tests, they, you know, the Wall Street Journal called the SAT the student affluence test. And it really is how much resources the family can throw at, you know, the test prep that tell the tale. And these test prep tutors are not cheap. You know, they can be, you know, $100, $200, $400, $500 an hour for a really good SAT test prep tutor. And by the way, they don't teach the student anything about material. They teach them test-taking tricks. And so when you look at that, you say it gives outsized advantage to the affluent. The kids that need the least help get the advantage from that. And when you look at the types of questions on them, I talked before about math. They're low-level questions that people professionally just relegate to computational resources. And the language arts are often things like reading passage you find completely boring and answer a multiple-choice question about signs of author bias or something. And, you know, like, is that really getting at something fundamental? I don't think so. So I think we're seeing some cracking in that wall, and I think it will start to let different kids shine in different ways. I support this thing called the Coalition for Access, which is an alternative way to apply to college, where they give a fair amount of weight to examples of the student's very best work. And I think that's a more authentic, more insightful way to gauge a student's potential. Like, show me what you did instead of show me how many hours you prepped for a test that's chock full of questions that really aren't very relevant in life. And by the way, you know, the SOL is one of the things I always encourage is that the state legislators that jam these tests down the throats of our schools ought to take these tests with a proctor and publish their scores. Because I guarantee you the state legislators that think these are important things would not do very well on the SOL for 11th graders. And so, you know, if it's really important in life, it ought to be something that the most adults can demonstrate competency with. And if they can't, then why are we blocking kids from getting a high school degree over some of these tests? I think that's a fair question.
Well, I would also add, Ted, that either you or I would advocate that we get rid of assessment, which is an entirely different conversation than talking about tests, that assessing learning, both assessing for learning to be sure that kids are on target and moving towards acquiring the knowledge and the competence that they need, but also assessment of learning. And that can look like a lot of different outcomes, from portfolios that kids create to performance-based assessments that give kids really engaging, challenging tasks to do that allows them to show what they're learning and thinking, and where there's not necessarily just one, you know, choose the letter A or the letter D because there's just one right answer, but how do kids really demonstrate competencies in a lot of different ways and maybe not through the same pathway. I think the mastery transcript, which comes out of the private schools, Ted, is another interesting idea of how do kids show that they have mastered learning through the products that they create. And it's interesting because most of the schools that are in that are private, but guess who in Albemarle County is? Murray High School is a affiliate of the Mastery Transcript Group. So there's, you know, there's assessment and there's testing. And I think that what Ted and I both advocate for is trying to really level the playing field by giving kids a variety of opportunities to show what they know and can do. So that would be something that I would put out there. And when kids are engaged and they're loving the work they're doing and they're interested in it, you will see a much higher level of performance than when they're disengaged from all of our kids.
Sunday morning wake-up call here with Ted Dentersmith and Dr. Pam Moran. And here we are, Sunday morning wake-up call. Ted Dentersmith, you can find his website is teddentersmith.com. Some pretty interesting information there. Check it out. One of the things that you'll find are some videos, and we'll get into that in just a second. Our other guest, Dr. Pam Moran, familiar name. She's also the executive director at the Virginia School Consortium for Learning. I've mentioned that multiple times. In just a second, we'll have Pam tell us exactly what that's all about. Ted, on the website, you have videos. One of them that I found to be pretty entertaining as well as informative. A lot of the material that we've gotten into today is what is school for? Certainly talking about the material that's being taught in school. One of the topics is why aren't kids being taught life skills such as taxes, how to purchase a home, and apply for a loan? But my follow-up to that is, why are schools being asked to do things that families, why shouldn't families be teaching these life skills?
Well, you know, in a lot of cases, families aren't equipped to do it. I mean, you know, the degree of financial literacy across the country is actually not sky high. And so I think it's actually one of the real puzzles here, which is, if you look at financial literacy, there's an enormous amount of important math that underlies financial literacy. I mean, it gets all the way to portfolio management when you're buying a diversified set of stocks. And when you look at the number of times people will do this, well, they will survey adults and ask them some very basic financial literacy questions, and the adults strike out. So it's not just we don't teach it to our kids in school, but somehow it's magically happening. I mean, it's just not happening. And so you look at this and say, hey, I mean, you heard me talk about how I think a lot of times these standardized tests aren't doing as much good. But you could use some really great math in the context of financial literacy. I mean, think about compound interest and exponential functions when it comes to loans you take out and how the interest compiles. And I think it's an opportunity. There may be a half a dozen states that require any, but 44 of the 50 states require no financial literacy for kids. And I think where it starts to come into play is if these kids, when they get out of school, they're given credit cards and they don't understand what it means to deal with a float that suddenly is compounding at 15, 18, 21% annual compound interest rate. Kids, I will interview a bunch of kids, well, kids, I call them kids, but young adults, sort of, you know, 25, 30 years old. I'll say, do you have any student loan debt? The answer will be kind of like, I do. And I'll say, how much? And they'll say, I don't know, I'll check. They get back to me. I say, you know, it's like, whoa, $125,000 of student loan debt. How did that happen? Well, I don't know. I mean, they gave me these forms and I had to sign them and they said it would all be fine. And then it's like, well, are you paying it off? Are you current? Well, no, I'm not. Now the interest rate's 10, 15, 20%. You know, adults get into a deep pile of trouble with imprudent financial decisions. And if, in fact, there's deep math behind it, if, in fact, that math has real relevance to the real world, and if, in fact, it's an important life skill, you know, maybe occasionally a kid has an accountant for a parent or somebody that can teach it and actually takes the time to do it. But I don't think that's happening. And so, to me, it's this enormous opportunity to make the math relevant and interesting, to equip a kid with a vital life skill, and to actually have them, when they ask, why am I learning this? You say, well, you're learning it so you don't get it yourself into a situation where you feel like you can't get out of it. Because there are a lot of adults, I am sure, that people listening know somebody or might even be in that situation where you're just in this deep hole financially, and you're not quite sure how it happened, and it just kind of rolls over you. And so, you know, it's I think, important. I think it's a fair question to ask of our school systems, like, why the heck not? I mean, tell me why trait proofs are more important than financial literacy. Tell me why factoring polynomials is more important. Tell me why doing a hyperbolic cosine transformation of a closed form integral when no adults ever use that is more important. I mean, this is just common sense. Teach kids something that's important in life that draws out important things. And talking about teaching you how to think, I think a lot of these things are absolutely going to help kids learn to think logically and clearly about important problems.
My question isn't that I disagree with you. My question is, what is the responsibility of the family if we take things away that at one point were family responsibilities to teach things like cooking and how to write a check and things like that, and said, here you go, school. I mean, that's part of the expectation now, not expectation, but that's one of the complaints that you hear regularly now. And I don't want to get too far off track, but people say, I can't, why isn't the school taking the kids? I want my kids to go to school, because otherwise, what am I supposed to do with my kids? I don't have any daycare. Wait a minute. The school isn't the daycare. I mean, think about it in the proper form. And I'm not disagreeing with you on whether or not Pythagorean theorem is more important than learning how to be responsible for your interest rate on this god-awful amount of debt that can accrue just for having to go to school. I'm just asking, does the school become responsible for what were at one point family responsibilities?
Well, I think it's kind of an interesting point, because I will tell you, back in the day when I was a kid in high school, and that was a very long time ago, that some of the classes that were considered essentials were shop class, home ec class, automotive class. You could get through high school and maybe have some higher level courses, but you were also going to take those classes that we'd at the time called vocational classes. And there are things I still use in my kitchen today in terms of skill sets that come from learning some of those skills back in the day in school that didn't have anything to do with my mother. But on the other hand, for me, the most important thing is that schools, and, you know, and this can sound like, you know, well, yeah, everybody says that parents and educators should be partners in their kids' learning. And I've had at least one mentor in life who used to remind me that, you know, parents are their children's first teachers. But one of the things I think that we're struggling with right now is that in a time of remote learning with kids at home and parents, oftentimes two parents working, parents who are essential workers, that this is an unusual and unique time. But I think there are some silver linings in it, because I think the educators are learning a lot about the challenges that families have in being able to help their kids, in being able to resource their kids, and that maybe there are some educators that are rethinking their expectations for what kids, all kids, should be able to have in place at home in order to do the work that we sometimes expect that gets done at home. On the other thing, I think that parents in many cases have a renewed appreciation of what it must be like for a teacher to manage learning for 25 kids in a class or 130 kids in a school day, depending on what grade level it is, based on their experiences trying to educate kids at home. And so I see some things that have come out of this in terms of perhaps having a little bit better understanding of the challenges both at home and at school for kids. On the other hand, I think that there have been some places that have really figured out how to do some things that are pretty engaging that involve families in the work with kids and are able to make some of those situations with virtual learning work. But, yeah, I mean, I think that there are things that we want parents to have direct responsibility for, and I think that there are things that schools have some direct responsibility for, and where we can find the intersections in being able to leverage those two areas together, I think that kids actually get some really good opportunities from both home and school. Unfortunately, as Ted said, we have a lot of kids that may not have the same level of affluence that allows them to have access to the resources that others have. And boy, have we really learned the impact that if your community or region does not have good connectivity in terms of internet, then we've got kids that are being left at the table with very little to do that is meaningful work, and others that perhaps are working in more synchronous virtual environments that are getting a better opportunity. And so we've got a lot of work to do around education. And, you know, we talk about it and we tinker with it, but in general, we haven't done the big changing shifts that we need to take on to really be able to have all of our kids get the kind of education that Ted's describing and that he's seen all over the country. But it's kind of pockets of excellence, Ted, versus being something you have seen uniformly.
Yeah. And I just want to follow up because it's an important point, and I want to make sure that, you know, that I cover it. You know, so I would be willing to wager that the number of 18-year-olds leaving high school in America today that are really good in terms of financial literacy is, if it's 1 in 100, I'd be surprised. And you know, if it's offered in high school and a kid is getting great coaching on financial literacy at home, but there just aren't that all to the good. But there really aren't that many parents at home that could teach a kid, you know, not just writing a check, but, you know, how do you compute compound interest? If you take out a mortgage for 30 years at 8%, borrowing $100,000, what are you paying over the lifetime? You know, like, there are some really interesting trade-offs and questions around that get to some very fundamental math concepts that both are important, that have all the thinking, you know, teaching you how to think aspects of it you would want, but also make it real. And so if it's offered, if a kid happens to get that at home, but I don't think it's a fair assumption, nor do I think it's the right choice to say, oh, let's leave that up to parents and let 43 million adults be drowning in student loan debt today and say, oh, the parents didn't get to that, so sorry. You mentioned cooking. You know, like, I write about in my book this initiative in North Carolina, and this teacher teaches kids culinary, but she goes on about how she uses that as a window for kids to learn ratios and fractions, for kids to learn about anatomy, for kids to learn the chemistry and physics of actually cooking. And you realize if you just sort of say, you know, like spaghetti and meatballs, you know, okay, that's quite elementary. That doesn't belong in schools. I could see somebody listening and saying that we don't need that. But if you really take it seriously and, you know, teach it really well, first, there are going to be kids that are exceptional at that might not shine on factoring polynomials. Second, the kids who take it will, as adults, be able to cook, which is not such a bad thing. But third is, and I love the saying, anything can lead to everything if you just have an imagination. I used to coach my kids' baseball and soccer teams. And I was, at first, parents were skeptical because I would give my kids homework assignments that were math. And my parents say, wait, you're just coaching a baseball team. You're coaching 9-year-olds baseball and you're giving them a math homework assignment? What is going on with this? But what we found was it was a great thing to talk about at practices. We actually had very good teams, too, so it didn't, like, cost us, you know, our performance on the field. But it also let kids who weren't the great baseball player explain to other kids why sacrifice bunt when you have one out and a player on second might not be the right thing. And you realize anything leads to everything if you bring imagination to it. Find what the kid's interested in and build from that to the history of sports, to the math behind sports, to the anatomy of sports, to the physics of baseball. Why does a knuckleball flutter? And when you start to think about education that way and you start to tie it to real-world things that kids are actually fascinated with, you suddenly open up deep, retained, joyful learning. And that's what it's all about. And one of the things I think we need to really recognize and understand is any teacher listening to this is not going to say, oh, my God, I never thought of that. This is why they enter the profession. This is what they want to do with our kids. And when you standardize it, when you hold them accountable to tests that aren't that well designed in the first place, you take their joy out of teaching and you take the kids' joy out of learning. And so if we live in a world that's going to value creative, distinctive kids who are good at things that the next kid over isn't good at, if that's going to be what lets that kid lead a great life with a fulfilling career and a sense of purpose, then we need to sort of work with kids on their basis, find their strengths, find their budding interests, help them blossom into adults that can make their way forward in life. That's what I write about, what I talk about, what I get excited about. And I think Virginia's doing, on balance, a really good job there, whereas a lot of other states are just kind of glossing over the issue.
Yeah, and I think that one of the places where Ted and I also talk, and he's one of the few people I know that had that double major where he was both, what, Ted, an English major and a what down at William & Mary?
Physics, yeah.
English and physics, there's a combination for you, which actually probably isn't that far apart. But one of the things that I really think about is that, you know, we are really looking for how does school help kids acquire competencies that really help them be people who can thrive in life. And, you know, some people may call it the social-emotional dimension of learning, which doesn't happen with having people in isolation of each other. As a kid said to me one time at Monticello High School, you know, Ms. Moran, y'all keep talking about collaboration, but if I spend the whole day staring at the heads of a person sitting in front of me listening to a teacher talk, I'm not going to be learning much about collaboration. And so one of the things that I think about is that the skills of life that help people be successful oftentimes are less about the content that we teach initially in elementary, middle, or high school, and much more about the competencies of things like thinking. And obviously you have to have things to think about, but if you're interested in what you're thinking about, whether it's trying to figure something out around financial literacy or whether it's something that relates to culinary arts or to music, then you probably are going to have kids that leave school equipped with far more than just some content that they're holding on. So, you know, I'm with Ted on that, but I think that our goal is we're not looking at saying that STEM is the one path to this kind of work or that we need to be more humanities-centered. We think our kids really need to be learning things that are going to help them thrive in life that are much more competency-based than just content-focused.
Yeah, I often say, you know, it's true, actually. I spent my career in technology businesses, and my English background was far more helpful than physics or a PhD in engineering. And so because I learned how to write. And, you know, but I think it's that helping kids find something they're passionate about and getting them to a point where they're excellent at it. And if a kid's motivated, if they find it interesting and they get the right adult support, they can do it.
Just fascinating. We could keep going. I need to have you two back very soon, because schools are just going to keep going and changing and being an issue. Ted Dentersmith, author, creator of films and videos, teddentersmith.com. Pam Moran, she's the executive director at the Virginia School Consortium for Learning, Albemarle County Superintendent, 2006 to 2018. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on Real Oldies 97.9 The Wren. The Wake Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at cvillepodcast.com. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for The Wake Up Call, only on 97.9 The Wren.